Stella's just emailed me with a list of Urbexes, possibly rogue ones, that she, Will and Lisa got together for us last night. She'd understandably forgotten all about it when she heard about Emily chasing after Kenny Asquith, then Tom having been rushed to hospital.
"Any names that register with you, Robbie? Anyone known to us?" asked Jackman.
"Not at first glance, sir, but I'll run them through the PNC.
Robbie looked at the email.
"There is one that flagged up concern for Stella, but no one can remember his name. It wasn't him so much as the sequence of events and the man's sudden appearance on a trip to Yorkshire that worried her."
He read from the paper.
"She says they were looking at an old manor house from where a girl once went missing without a trace. She's chasing that up on her UE website for us."
"Good. What are the other names, by the way?"
Jackman asked.
"Roy Ferris, Jeff Saville, a chap called Henry, and the man with no name."
Robbie skimmed to a postscript.
"Ah, she's added that she since discovered that the guy called Henry's surname is Arnott."
Jackman and Marie looked at each other.
"That's who rushed to the hospital to see Callie Prothero after she had that terrible fright the night before last," exclaimed Marie.
"And she's gone to stay with him,"
Jackman breathed, feeling suddenly nauseous.
Robbie pulled a face.
"Stella said he's not a serious contender for being a person of interest. His main problem was being over-intense about industrial buildings and locations. He was very knowledgeable by all accounts, just not well-liked."
That didn't make Jackman feel any easier.
"Marie, have we got his number?"
"Yes, I noticed it as I was sorting this info for ORAC. I'll get it."
She hurried across to her workstation.
"Ring him and talk to Callie. I need to know she's safe," called out Jackman.
"I'm on it, boss."
A few moments later, he heard her speaking.
"Henry Arnott? Sorry to bother you, sir. I'm DS Marie Evans at Salton Police Station. I'm phoning to see how Callie Prothero is now."
Jackman and Robbie came and stood beside her, so she put the conversation on speaker. Henry Arnott had a well-spoken, educated voice.
"Oh, thank you for inquiring, Sergeant Evans," he sighed. "She's some way from being recovered, as you would expect after a shock on that scale, but she is much better than when she was in hospital."
"That's good to know," said Marie cautiously.
"She sleeps a lot, but I guess that's the medication. She said she never takes drugs, prescription or otherwise, so I think they've affected her a little more than someone who is used to taking medicines regularly."
The man sounded reasonable and apparently very caring.
"I wondered if I could have a quick word with her, Mr. Arnott, just to assure her that we're doing all we can to find the person responsible. I don't want her to feel that we're treating her situation lightly. We are very worried for her."
"She'll appreciate that, I'm sure. I don't have to tell you, to be diplomatic, though. You'll understand that she's still very shaky. She just wants things back to normal, but I fear that will take time. Hold on, Sergeant. I'll take the phone up to her room."
They heard the sound of his footsteps on the stairs, and Jackman began to relax a little. The man seemed quite happy to let them talk to her. He heard the sound of a gentle tap on the door, and Arnott calling her name. They all waited, then heard the door opening.
"Damn it!" Arnott exclaimed and groaned. "She's not here, Sergeant. Her joggers and sweatshirt have gone, and her running shoes.
She said she wanted to start getting back to her usual routine, but I told her it was too soon to go running."
He groaned again. "I'm so sorry. I should have watched her more closely, but I thought she was sleeping. I haven't seen her for a couple of hours."
With a grimace, Marie said calmly, "Try not to worry, sir. Have you any idea of the route she would take?"
"None at all. She isn't familiar with this area, so she could have gone in any direction. Oh, hell."
"Has she got her phone with her, sir?" demanded Marie more forcibly now.
There was a short pause, then he said,
"No, it's still beside her bed."
Jackman closed his eyes, all the old anxiety flooding back. A seasoned and expert lone urbexer like Callie would never leave their phone behind when going jogging in a strange area.
"Stay put, sir. We're on our way."
Marie ended the call and stared at her notes.
"He lives in Leesholm Village, on the main road out of Salton in the Fenchester direction. House named Heather Set in Cold Harbour Lane. Shall we attend, sir?"
He turned to Robbie.
"You hold the fort and get to work finding all you can about Henry Bloody Pickwick, Arnott. And get Gary and Max, when he returns, onto the other two on Stella's list. We need backgrounds on them all."
Robbie nodded.
"Got it."
Right, Marie, let's get moving. Do you know where this Cold Harbor Lane is?
Marie pulled on her jacket. More or less, boss. I know the village, and I'm sure that lane leads out onto open farmland. I'll drive if you would put the location into the sat-nav, just to make sure.
10 minutes later, they were on their way out of town and heading for Lee's home.
More bad vibes, boss. I'm getting pretty sick of them, Marie said.
Me too. That kid has suffered enough. I'll never forgive myself if we've let her walk into a trap.
Had Henry Arnott been properly vetted?
Maybe not. After all, according to Callie, he was a close friend, so why check him at all? Knowing how vulnerable she is, we should have looked more closely at that man, he muttered.
We can't check everyone, sir, you know that. It was her choice to call him. He didn't march in and insist on taking her out.
Marie was being perfectly reasonable, but he couldn't help worrying about Callie Protheroe. After what she had witnessed, her mental state was bound to be precarious.
She trusted him, Jackman. Let's hold on to that, shall we? Marie said softly.
Not everyone deserves the trust that others place in them, he said. We've seen that demonstrated countless times. I'll only feel better once I've seen her for myself.
Okay, I agree. What did you make of him when you spoke? She asked.
Jackman thought back to the phone call. Initially, I was reassured, especially when he offered to take the phone up to her. He sounded like an academic, didn't he? Someone used to sitting in libraries rather than exploring old buildings.
Strikes me, sir, that these Urbexes come from every possible background. Take Kenny Asquith, a millionaire's son, and then Aaron Smith, a schoolboy daredevil who fell out with his parents and lived in a tiny flat with another kid. This exploring game clearly attracts all sorts. Marie negotiated a roundabout and swung off down a leafy lane towards Lee's home village.
A few roads later, the sat-nav told her to take the next left, and in 500 meters she would have reached her destination.
Heather said,
said Jackman, pointing to a rather pleasant detached house set back off the lane.
And will you look at that?
Seated on a garden bench outside the front of the property was a tall, well-built man of around 45. He had his arm around Callie Prothero's slender waist.
I just rang your office. I'm so sorry. I'm afraid I brought you out on a wild goose chase.
Henry Arnott held out his hand to them. Come in. I'll make a drink.
Jackman was supremely relieved.
Inside, Henry ushered them into a comfortable lounge. Somewhat dated and dominated by a recliner and walking frame, it was clearly arranged to suit an elderly person. Callie sank into an armchair and looked at them apologetically.
I'm so sorry, officers. I know I should never have gone off alone like that. I just felt, well, trapped, I guess. I'm used to doing things whenever I feel like it, being active, not crashed out in bed for hours at a time. I never meant to scare anyone, especially Henry. I thought I'd be back before he noticed I'd gone. It was just that the walls were coming in on me.
Jackman noted that she had a kind of hollow look about her, but he guessed that was to be expected after what she had seen. It had been bad enough for them, and they were hardened to such sights.
As long as you're safe, Callie, that's all that matters, said Marie. Oh, yes, and Henry's been so kind when he's not visiting his father, who's in respite care for a week or so. He's been looking after me like a mother hen, bless him.
She sank back in the chair, as if she lacked the energy to even sit up.
I don't understand why this has affected me like this. I'm usually so strong and independent, I feel like a weak child. I only ran a little way, and then I had to walk back. I was so exhausted, I didn't think I'd make it back to the house.
She looked near to tears.
And I forgot my phone. I never do that.
Don't underestimate what shock can do, Callie, said Jackman.
And Henry's right to let you sleep as much as possible. It will help.
I've never slept so much in my life.
Callie looked thoroughly miserable.
I went to bed at 9 last night and didn't wake up until after 7 this morning. That's unheard of for me.
Jackman wished he had the chance to sleep like that.
I expect the doctors gave you something to help you relax, didn't they? I'm betting it's making you sleepy, so don't fight it.
Henry had brought a tray of drinks. He set it down on the coffee table in front of them.
Help yourself. I hope you all like tea. I don't drink coffee, so there's none in the house, I'm afraid.
They thanked him, and then Jackman said,
Did you explore too, Henry?
Henry sat down in the recliner.
Many moons ago, I gave up when my father began to need more care. When I moved in with him and became his full-time carer, it put an end to my Urbex days.
He gave a little laugh.
And to be honest, I wasn't very popular with the others. I was a bit too intense for some of them. I have a real passion for Victorian industry, and like nothing better than getting into an old mill or a factory. But I do get a bit carried away.
He glanced across to Callie.
We became friends through work and then discovered that we shared an interest in urban exploration.
Jackman decided to chance his arm.
This is a long shot, but did either of you ever hear of an expedition to some Elizabethan manor house up in Yorkshire? Apparently it attracted a bit of an oddball. Someone the Urbexes decided had an ulterior motive for going out with them.
On hearing this, Callie, who'd been looking half asleep, roused herself. Was that Will and Lisa Sheringham's clan?
Jackman nodded. It was a while back, before Will got hurt.
They put a warning up on one of the websites after that incident, Callie said. They were quite unnerved, as I recall. But to my knowledge, he never reappeared. He must have only been interested in that particular old house.
Oh, well, it was worth a try.
Jackman swallowed a mouthful of tea.
We should let you rest, Callie. We'll let you know how the inquiry goes, I promise. But no going off alone and scaring Henry again, all right?
She looked thoroughly contrite. I promise, and thank you for coming out. I'm sorry I wasted your time.
As they drove back to Salton, Marie said,
So, what's your opinion of Henry Arnott now?
Jackman was forced to admit he had been wrong.
Not what I thought. He genuinely cares about it, doesn't he?
Marie laughed. He does more than that. Didn't you notice the way he was looking at her?
Oh.
Jackman looked blank.
No.
Marie rolled her eyes. Men, he's head over heels in love with her.
He is?
Oh, yes. I'm not sure if she's aware of it yet, but I'm guessing he won't be able to conceal it from her for too much longer.
She laughed again.
Well, that's cheered me up. That look of total bemusement on your face, Jackman, is priceless.
Marie spent the next hour collating info for Orak. Then she took it down to the basement. As soon as she walked into the IT department, she sensed a totally different atmosphere. As always, everyone was busy, but there was a buzz about the place.
The best thing was seeing Orak seated once again in front of her massive array of screens as if on a throne. From across the basement, Leon beamed at her, and David and Philip gave her friendly waves, like zombies who had suddenly been raised from the dead.
Orak accepted the armful of reports and notes Marie handed to her and licked her lips.
I can't wait to get to grips with the work I love. My kind of detective work.
Neither can I, said Marie with feeling. All I can think about is that young man, crazy Hazy, and wondering if he's alive or dead. We know what the magician has in store for him, so it's whether we can find him in time to prevent it happening.
Philip has just located his parents' mobile home, dear Sevens, so we should know where they are, called Leon. Would you like the details, or should we tell Uniform?
Both. Notify Uniform immediately, but I'll make a note of it as well.
Good work, Philip. You're definitely getting closer to that new tie.
Philip ran a hand down his chosen tie for the day, a scarlet blaze of flames leaping into an indigo sky.
Wow, said Marie. Must be unique.
Probably, because no other silly bugger would be seen dead in it, said David, with a grin.
Jealousy, muttered Philip. Pure jealousy.
Marie turned back to Orak. I'll let you have anything else that comes in.
But Orak was already head down and reading. As soon as Marie was back, Jackman held a serious case emergency meeting. Uniform, represented by the duty officer Sergeant Terry Curtis, several PCs, and as many detectives as could be mustered. They all needed to be able to see the whole picture, not just the aspect of it that they were dealing with.
In brief, we have an unknown white male, who we are referring to as the Magician, seemingly cherry-picking certain young men who practice urban exploration. He isolates his victims, immobilizes them with the use of an extremely painful pressure point technique, and takes them to another abandoned building where, while they are still alive, he suspends them by one ankle, until death occurs.
The image of what he and Marie had seen in that bell tower rose before him, and he paused briefly.
He pointed to three of the photographs on the whiteboard.
These are the deceased.
Anthony Hood, Aaron Smith, and Grant Leach. He then indicated to a fourth picture. And this is Keith Hazel, known to his compatriots as Crazy Hazy. Last night he was abducted from an abandoned control tower on the catchwater drain at Hartley Fen. He looked around the room. The magician achieved this despite the presence of myself, D.C. Robbie Melton, and another man, Tom Chalk, an expert urban explorer. We fear that he intends, or maybe already has, murdered this young man in the same way as he did the others. Jackman drew in a breath. We can find no connection whatsoever between the victims or the locations he chose. The magician has only been seen once, indistinctly, by Tom Chalk just before he was attacked. He describes a white male of around 40, well-built and wearing camouflage trousers, and a distinctive bomber jacket with a logo on or above the breast pocket. Even though a roadblock was set up to stop him getting off Hartley Fen, the magician got away. Traffic cameras have failed to pick up a vehicle leaving on the main road, so we suspect he used the back lanes to get as far as possible from the site. "Slippery bugger, isn't he?" murmured someone. "And very dangerous," added Jackman. "I've seen firsthand what he's capable of." Sergeant Terry Curtis stood up. "We have had officers watching as many abandoned buildings as we can, sir, but there are just too many and too scattered to watch them all. It's an impossible task." "And probably a waste of time and resources," agreed Jackman. "We have no idea what his agenda is or where he will strike next. In short, we're no sod all." He began to pace. "Our hopes now lie with forensics. Maybe he's left a trace, some DNA on one of the victims, and we can track him that way. We also have IT doing a comprehensive computer search, hunting for anomalies and possible connections. The solution to this case might come down to technology and science, rather than manpower and the human element." He was giving them so little to go on. He smiled ruefully. "I know, I know. This is not what you wanted to hear. But there are one or two peculiarities about his MO that are worth considering." He pointed to a gruesome post-mortem shot of Aaron Smith. "The magician removes the victim's clothes and dresses them in a kind of sacking tunic. Their own clothes and belongings are then carefully washed, packed, and sent to Professor Rory Wilkinson at the morgue. The packages include a list, plus the name, age, and occupation of the victim. So, what is that all about?" He paused. "Then there is the way he hangs them by their left ankle. It has been noted that this position is reminiscent of the hanged man in a set of tarot cards." He pinned a printout of an enlarged picture of the card on the board next to the forensic ones. "Do you see Stoner, anything show up on that?" Kevin stood up. "Nothing that I can find apart from the resemblance to the image. Like a lot of cards in the deck, the meanings vary. Some are negative, some positive. But I can find no connection to any other aspect of the case. Sorry, sir." He sat down again. Jackman spread his hands. "So, we disregard that line of inquiry for the time being. Thank you, Kevin. Which means, bottom line, the magician has a list, and he is working his way through it. We have no way of knowing whether Crazy Hazy is the last, or indeed how long the list might be." He looked at Robbie and Max. "Were either of you able to check out those possible rogue urban explorers that we were given?" Max raised his hand. "My luck with Roy Ferris seems to have disappeared from the area." Robbie glanced at his notebook. "And it can't be Jeff Saville, because his volatile temper caused him to deck a police officer a week back, broke his jaw, so he's in custody in Hull. Anne-Marie and I saw Henry Arnott ourselves. He is looking after his friend, the urbexer Callie Prothero, and he doesn't give us cause for concern." He caught a glimpse of Marie grinning at the word friend. "The last one, the anonymous male who joined the trip to the Yorkshire Manor House, was possibly a journalist," added Max. "No proof yet, but from his description, we think that might have been the case." Jackman ended the meeting. "Okay, people, it's now your job to find me something, anything, no matter how small, that indicates who the magician might be or why he's doing what he is." Back in his office, he phoned Rory Wilkinson.
"I hate to push you, Prof, but I'm struggling here. Do you have anything for me on those three victims?"
"I wish I could say I did,
but you are not alone in struggling, dear Inspector. We have identified the type of material used to make those tunic things, but I fear it won't do you much good. It is indeed Hessian, but it's a very common sort, used for all kinds of different purposes, from building, to protect brickwork from frost, to gardening, where they root ball large plants and use it for weed control. Oh, and the manufacture of sandbags.
Jackman sighed. He had feared as much.
However, I have yet another little conundrum to add to the growing list. We found ash in the hair and on the faces of all three bodies. It was easier to see on the last to die, young Grant Leach, and it appeared to have been smeared over his face and head. The ash came from burnt wood, kindling to be exact, and newspapers. So, we have sackcloth and ashes. Now, what does that tell you?
Penitence,
Jackman said immediately. This supports the theory that they violated a sacred space and have been made to pay, doesn't it?
That would be my take on it, Rory said. And they paid dearly.
Nothing else?
Your man wore gloves all the time. We could find nothing in those boxes of clothing and possessions, not even on the sealing tape he used, and no trace evidence on the bodies either. He was extraordinarily careful.
Rory sounded slightly puzzled.
That was also clinical. As you well know, whatever we do, we leave traces of ourselves. But in this case...
Don't stop looking, said Jackman.
It was almost a plea.
As if. What suggestion?
Rory exclaimed.
We still have to collate all the crap...
Sorry, evidence that we collected last night and early this morning from that old control tower and the surrounding scrubland.
He made three attacks there, so let's just hope that at some point he either got sloppy or simply overlooked something. It's possible. After all, he couldn't have been expecting such eminent company to turn up.
Don't remind me about that fiasco, Rory. If only I'd done things differently.
Rubbish. Get a grip, Inspector. That young lad, the millionaire's son, would have died if you hadn't got the paramedics out so quickly. That sort of attack on a boy with his condition could very easily be fatal, so forget the guilt trip and give yourself a pat on the back.
Jackman had to smile at this.
And finally, he used a car. We found where he parked it, and there were some juicy tire prints, so we might well get you a make of vehicle. Have faith, dear man, we are still on the case.
After he'd hung up, Jackman pulled a memo sheet towards him and drew a line through Jeff Saville, and put a question mark next to Roy Ferris. He was about to do the same with Henry Arnott when, for some reason, he hesitated. Recalling their meeting, he was forced to admit that Henry's gaze did rather linger on Kelly. Jackman had put it down to simple concern. Marie had interpreted it differently. What if they were both right? What if that look had been one of obsession? Arnott had admitted that he was obsessive about things. What if that extended to Kelly Prothero? And another thing bothered him. The hospital had given the girl a prescription for a mild sedative, but she had exhibited all the signs of near sedation, along with moments of full alertness. That seemed rather strange to him. He stood up and went to his door.
Marie, got a minute?
Marie heard him out with a look he knew well. It said that she was not convinced, but possibly prepared to consider it.
But are you saying he's drugging her? She added. That's a bit extreme, isn't it?
Jackman scratched his head thoughtfully.
I don't really know what I think, Marie, but somehow the whole scenario doesn't sit well with me, especially since you pointed out that he appears to have feelings for her.
Then I suggest we keep in close touch with Callie, just to be sure she's safe. We can't let anything else happen to her after all she's been through.
Marie drew in a long breath.
And keep Henry on the list of possible suspects. I've just remembered that Callie said she slept right through, from 9 at night until 7 in the morning. So Henry Arnott doesn't have an alibi, does he?
Jackman considered Arnott. He had been an urban explorer, so he knew his way around deserted buildings. He was the right height, the right age, more or less, and quite well built, too. But did he have the strength to lift a grown man and get him away from the control tower and across to his car? It was possible, because at some point in the conversation, Henry had admitted that he occasionally had to lift his father into bed. Rory has tire prints from out at the catchwater drain, Marie. We need to know what car Arnott drives, and also if he has more than one vehicle. As you say, just to be on the safe side.
Marie nodded. I'll get Kevin to do the honors, shall I?
Please, Murray.
As he watched her leave his office, Jackman had an idea. He picked up the phone and rang Laura.
Hello, darling, are you okay?
Her voice immediately lifted his spirits.
I'm fine. A few hours' sleep has done wonders. Listen, Laura, when do you have a follow-up appointment with Callie Prothero?
Tomorrow afternoon, I think. I'll check the diary, if you like.
No, it's okay. I was going to ask if you could ring her later this afternoon, just to check on her progress and make sure she attends that next appointment.
What's wrong? Laura said. Are you worried about her state of health?
I'll tell you when we get home. I just need to know if someone is keeping a close eye on her. Are you okay with that?
Of course, she said. But it would help to know why.
Later, I promise.
Okay, Mr. Mystery Man, I'll do what you ask, but you'd better fill me in as soon as possible, just so I know what to look for.
Somewhat relieved, Jackman hung up. Laura had a perfectly valid reason for calling Callie, and she would report back to him should anything concern her. So he could set that aside for the time being and press on with other problems. He sighed. His one big worry now was the whereabouts of Crazy Hazy. Was the lad still alive?
Chapter 28. It was 6:40 when Marie and Gary finally got away. Just enough time to get to the Golden Compass for their meeting with Ralph Enderby and John Beard. Reluctantly, Marie agreed to go in Gary's car, leaving her bike at the station with strict instructions to the night shift to keep a close eye on it. Marie was looking forward to seeing Ralph again. He was the kind of detective she liked. He had been enormously helpful during the Ashcroft investigation, and even though there was usually considerable competition between Fenchester and Sultan Le Fen, he had never had the slightest problem with sharing information.
"How long have you known John Beard?"
she asked Gary.
"Oh, hell. Must be well over 20 years, I suppose. We lost touch when I relocated to Sultan Le Fen. And then he and his wife, Nancy, moved to Randleby, and frankly I didn't expect to see him again. I'm delighted we've met up. He's a really good bloke."
"And he and Ralph know each other?" Marie smiled. "That's handy, since we're all looking into the same mystery."
Gary nodded. John worked at Fenchester Station as a civilian for several years. His experience with customs and excise made him quite a useful fellow to know. He pulled into the car park of the Golden Compass and managed to slot into the last remaining space.
"Busy tonight," commented Marie.
"Busy every night, according to John. The food is good, so I guess that explains it."
They got out.
"Bang on 7. At least we aren't late."
John and Ralph were already at the bar waiting for them. After the introductions, Ralph said,
"I wondered if you managed to get away, what with all the commotion in your neck of the woods at present."
He smiled warmly at her.
"But I'm glad you did. What are you both having?"
Marie decided to try the local best bitter, and Gary opted for a half of lager.
"We've got a table," said John. "There's a little alcove just off the main bar, so we can talk without being overheard."
He led the way, threading between groups of exuberant people, all waving glasses.
"First on the agenda," said Ralph, "is food. Let's order."
While the others all had steak, Ralph, to Marie's surprise, chose the vegetarian option. Marie didn't know too many vegetarian coppers, and she wondered what he ate out on Obo, when the only place to grab a snack was a greasy spoon. She asked him, and he grinned at her.
"Careful planning, Marie. I never leave home without a snack box."
"Now I feel guilty about the steak," she said.
Ralph laughed.
"You go ahead. If I got all sanctimonious about meat-eaters, I wouldn't last long in a police station, would I?"
"So, who's first?" she asked, looking from John to Ralph.
"After you, John," said Ralph, taking a gulp of his beer.
John leaned forward and lowered his voice.
"Well, I do have a lead. It means a short trip out of the county, but I'm happy to do that. Nancy is planning a shopping trip with her cousin tomorrow, so I thought I'd have an away day of my own."
Marie asked where he was going.
"Overstrand in Norfolk, close to Cromer."
"Okay," said Gary. "Tell us what you've got."
"Well, about 5 years ago, the great-grandfather of the lad that helps me with the garden moved from Randleby to a little seaside chalet at Overstrand. Young Josh reckons that if anyone can tell me about that airfield, it's this old man. His name is Sidney Packer.
Josh says that one of old Sydney's favourite stories is about a big wartime secret involving the old airfield. Josh had never heard the story himself. In fact, he wondered who his great-granddad actually did tell, because everyone in the family knew there was a secret, but no one seemed to know what it was. John shrugged. Maybe it's just a myth, an old man's joke on his family, but I don't think so. And since I could do with a breath of sea air, I'm off to Overstrand tomorrow morning.
It does sound promising, said Marie, although once again it's leading us to believe it's an old RAF field, which could pose problems should we delve deeper.
Big problems, added Ralph solemnly, all the laughter gone from his voice. And my news adds more support to the military theory. I ran it past a mate of mine that works in IT, and we did a bit of online ferreting on his personal computer. He loves rooting around in old archive stuff, and he knew where to look, but we couldn't find a thing. He stared into his beer. Well, this well and truly pissed off my friend, so I left it with him. He rang me this afternoon and said he'd got hold of every available list of decommissioned and former RAF stations and airfields, and there was no mention of Randleby anywhere. He then went the local history route and found just one reference, a record of a foreign Second World War military aircraft making an emergency forced landing at an RAF airfield in Lincolnshire. The name had been blacked out, but from other info in the document, including where the plane had been heading, he worked out that it had to be in this area, and that was all he could find. Every single bit of information on it has been erased. According to all official records, it doesn't exist. Yet there are old airfields all over this county, John said. During the Second World War, there were thought to be 100 military airfields, including dummy ones and emergency landing strips. You can look up the history of almost all of them with no trouble at all.
They destroyed a lot of paperwork after the war, said Gary. I watched a program about it on the History Channel, so I suppose it's possible that all the records on our airfield went up in smoke.
That would be perfectly understandable. But why are the higher powers deliberately obstructing all inquiries about the place? Why did I get a bollocking just for asking a few casual questions? Why are people lying?
Forget my last comment, said Gary glumly.
Marie was intrigued. She knew Lincolnshire was known as Bomber County, because at the outset of the Second World War, the bulk of all the bombers took off from the county. But there was so much more that she didn't know. She determined to find out more as soon as the Urbex investigation was over.
You mentioned old bases that were just abandoned, John, said Ralph. Well, while I was surfing the net, I came across a site that showed a massive one in Shropshire that one of Marie's urban explorers got inside of and found everything practically intact, even down to an RAF fire truck still in a garage.
Bit like RAF Manby Hall here, with all its equipment just left to rot, said John. That's quite eerie. They reckon it's haunted, too. Like a lot of places, they have all these regeneration projects lined up for them, and 9 times out of 10 they fall through when they are left to become derelict.
So I'm no closer to retrieving my old Norton, thought Marie.
That sad little motorcycle, discarded underneath a workbench, still haunted her.
"I have a question," she said. "What will happen if I decide that, as Aaron Smith was a murder victim, I want to cordon off the place as a crime scene? After all, that was where he was most likely taken from, unless he wandered off and was picked up somewhere else, which we all know is rubbish, especially as he had no vehicle of his own, and those 3 kids travelled there in the same car."
"Now, won't that be interesting?" murmured Ralph with a grin. "Is that your plan?"
She returned his smile. "We have to, don't we? The other places that victims disappeared from are already shut off while forensics go over them, so why not this one?"
"Okay, Rob and I did an unofficial visit that showed up nothing, except for a very tasty motorcycle," she thought to herself. "But there was no forensic sweep. I reckon we should go straight out there in the morning."
"Well, I can't wait to hear how that goes," said Ralph. He glanced up. "Ah, here comes our food."
Ralph turned out to be not just a friendly and helpful detective, but great company too. He hit it off immediately with Gary, which pleased Marie. She and Gary had become close friends and had shared some pretty rough times during the hunt for Alistair Ashcroft, and it was nice to see him relaxed and enjoying himself with like-minded people. After the waitress had cleared the table, Marie said, "I know your friend is obviously brilliant at IT, or he wouldn't be doing that particular job, but we have a genius tucked away in our basement at Salton.
Ah, the legendary Orak, said Ralph, with reverence.
Part human, part cyborg, he laughed.
So, she really exists.
She does, and she's absolutely incredible. I was wondering if she could do a little research into our non-existent airfield. What do you think?
Good idea, said Gary. She does have access to sites that others don't.
Gary went off to the gents, and John said he needed to ring his wife, so Murray and Ralph were left alone.
We'd better make a move soon, early start and all that, Murray said, rather regretfully. It's been a really nice evening.
We could do it again, offered Ralph softly. Just you and me?
Murray stiffened. It had become an automatic reaction whenever she caught the slightest hint of a prospective date. Then she heard herself say, I'd love to, as soon as we have this case wrapped up.
Now where had that come from?
Great. And meantime, I'll be dying to hear what happens when you take a load of coppers and sockos out to the airfield.
I'll keep you posted, Ralph, I promise.
John Beard lightly touched her shoulder.
I'm off now. I'll let Gary know how I get on in Overstrand.
Good luck, John. It's been nice to meet you. She shook his proffered hand. Take care.
Soon she and Gary were driving back towards Salton, Gary singing along with the radio as he drove.
That was a really nice night, she said. I like John. He's a solid bloke, isn't he? And Ralph's great fun, too.
Gary smiled at her.
I think Ralph is quite smitten with you.
Gary Pritchard, what are you suggesting?
I bet you anything you like that he asks you out before the end of tomorrow,
Gary laughed.
Well, you're too late. He already has.
I knew it. So, what did you say?
Gary was almost bouncing in his seat.
Hold up. We have a big case running, remember? No time for any of that until we have the magician locked up.
And then?
Maybe. She dug him in the ribs. Anyway, I don't do dates, Gary, you know that. I'll probably say no in the end.
Well, maybe it's time for a change. A good-looking detective who's also a nice man could be just what you need.
He glanced at her, suddenly serious.
Have some fun, Marie. We're a long time dead.
She knew that he was thinking of his lovely sister, who had died far too young.
And what about you, Gary? You're a fine one to talk. You never date anyone either.
He sighed.
True. The fact of it is, many years ago I got hurt, really hurt, and, well, I've never met anyone since who I feel I could share my life with. Since that one affair, all the women I've come into contact with have been just good friends or colleagues like you, buddies, comrades in arms, and in your case, a dear and trusted friend.
She squeezed his arm.
I'm sorry, Gary. It must have been bad.
It was a long time ago, Marie. I should have moved on, but after I lost my sister, I couldn't cope for a while. Work became the be-all and end-all, and I just stopped looking at women. I think I was scared of losing someone else. After all, I didn't have a very good track record of hanging on to them, did I?
Marie suddenly recalled a saying she'd heard about grief. It never ends, but it changes. It's a passage, not a place to stay.
Grief is the price of love, she said softly.
And maybe we've both been paying the price for too long, added Gary.
There have been an awful lot of maybes talked about this evening, haven't there?
Then maybe it's time to turn some of them into positive actions.
Gary slapped the steering wheel.
Okay, Marie Evans. After you. I'll see how you get on first, and then I might just give it a try.
Marie recalled Ralph's infectious laugh and good looks. A drink together, maybe even a meal, certainly wouldn't do any harm, would it?
Okay, Pritchard, you're on.
Well, maybe.
At exactly 23:45, the man pushed open the heavy door into the abandoned warehouse. The building was in a very poor state and due for demolition within a month or two, but it was perfect for what he needed. This unremarkable three-story red brick building had once been a pea-sorting warehouse. Locally grown peas had been brought here, transported by horse and cart, and were clean, sorted and packed for export. On one floor, the skeletal remains of one of the old pea-cleaning machines still sat, a rusting hulk of twisted metal. It wasn't easy getting the boy up the treacherous stairs. The man wore a helmet light and carried a powerful torch, but he was hampered by the struggling kid. He couldn't afford to immobilize him again. He wanted him awake and fully conscious, so he could appreciate exactly why he was here. That was vital. Finally, he reached the top of the stairs and manhandled the terrified explorer into the vast open area at the top of the building. He had already prepared for this, so it was just a matter of getting the timing right and winching Mr. Crazy Hazy into position. He flung the boy to the floor and stared down at him. Lying there trussed like a chicken, he looked much younger than his 20-odd years, especially since he was snivelling like a baby.
"Please, please don't hurt me. Let me go. I won't tell anyone anything, I swear. Just let me go."
The man sank down onto his heels and shook his head.
"It's too late. I've told you that, haven't I?"
He sounded patient and calm, as if explaining something to a child. He looked at his watch. 5 minutes to go. He'd better get him into position. Closing his ears to the screams, he dragged Keith Hazel, a.k.a. Crazy Hazy, along the filthy floor towards the end of a rope that was dangling from one of the old rafters. It took only moments to loop the climbing rope around the left ankle and secure it tightly. It was expensive sports line, lightweight, flexible and very strong. Once he had him secured, he stepped back and calmly assessed the situation. The rope would slide easily over the rafter. He had sanded the area carefully until it was smooth and free from splinters.
"Time to go," he said softly.
With gloved hands, he pulled the loose end of the rope and slowly took the weight of Crazy Hazy's body. Once his victim was clear of the floor and some 4 feet in the air, he secured the rope to a temporary hook he had screwed into the floor, took a sharp knife to the nylon twine that bound him, and allowed his limbs to fall free. He then took a sealed plastic bag from his pocket and scooped out a handful of ashes, which he rubbed over the young man's head. He stood back. The shouting and coughing gradually subsided to a painful sobbing.
"What are you doing to me? What have I done? Why me?"
He didn't reply. He needed all his strength to pull the body up and under the rafters. This took him exactly 1 minute. Then, breathing deeply, he tied the rope off and stared up at the figure in the sackcloth tunic. The alarm on his watch beeped. It was done. He sat on the floor.
"How does it feel?"
There was a croaking, sobbing sound.
"Please, please, get me down. I'm scared."
"I know. You know. And that's as it should be. You have to understand, Keith, actions are followed by reactions. It's how the world works."
"But I haven't done anything."
The voice rose into a wail.
"But you have, Keith. Or should I say Crazy? I know you, Crazy Hazy, and I know exactly what you've done. And now you're finally paying for it. The simple law of cause and effect."
He stood up, took one last look at the young man suspended above him, and walked towards the door. The screams grew more and more hysterical, but he shut them out. Screaming would do young Crazy Hazy no good. This strange old place was remote. The spot attracted no one. And the building itself was pretty soundproof. Maybe it had been built that way on purpose. He smiled in satisfaction, closed the door, negotiated the staircase, and finally stepped outside into the night chill. He took a lungful of the crisp, clean air and exhaled loudly. Aurak sat on in the half-dark of the basement. She desperately wanted to talk to someone, but she didn't have the heart to disturb either Dara or Marie at 2 in the morning. Her table was scattered with reports, interviews, statements. Her gaze was drawn to the photographs and the image of a man's left foot, tightly secured with the cord rope that rock climbers used. The knot ensured that the attached weight would not slip or come loose. Why did that seem so significant? She stood up and paced to the big area, which was silent other than the hum of the air conditioner and the occasional chirrup from one of her computers as it made yet another update or download. This was not how she had envisaged her homecoming. Thoughts swarmed in her mind, not all to do with this nightmare of a case. Her beautiful sister, and the sorrow of knowing that she had been so close yet turned away. Would she make another attempt? Possibly not. Orak went through to the locker room. There was no point in staring any longer at those reports. She would go home and sleep for a few hours and then come back and try again to make sense of what was worrying her. She took her jacket from the locker and pulled it on. It would be good to sleep in her own bed again, even if her apartment had been trashed by the agents trying to discover where she had gone. There had been no real damage, however, just objects out of place and furniture moved. She could live with that. And she mustn't forget to go and pick up her car. She had taken it to a lock-up garage that she had rented in case she ever needed it. She had left her car there as a decoy, to make people think she had gone off in it and so waste time hunting for her in the traffic cameras. From there, she had rung a 24-hour taxi firm and paid an extortionate fee to be taken to the airport. She booked a flight for the next day, stayed over in the airport hotel, and the following morning left the country. Now she was home, worrying over the case that had broken in her absence. Jackman and Marie needed her help badly, and she was determined to help them. She could, she knew, she had the skill. But if she had never gone away, would those young men have died? What if? Orak shook herself. She must be very overtired. She never thought like that. No one could rewrite the past. She ought to know that more than most. She slammed the door shut and went up to reception. As she passed, the night duty sergeant lifted a hand to her and called out,
"Good night, Miss Kraken. Good to have you back."
She didn't recall him ever speaking before. It felt good.
"Thank you, Sergeant, and good night to you too."
Yes, it was good to be back. Chapter 29. Still a little jaded, but better than he had been, Jackman got in early. The previous night he and Laura had sat up late, discussing their old friend Sam Page. Laura had rung Sam and put the suggestion to him. How would he like to come and live with them at Mill Corner, but in a separate self-contained flat? Overwhelmed by their generosity, Sam's voice had broken. Weeping, he had turned down their offer. He was settling in again, happy in his solitude. Laura said they would leave the offer open, and that if he should ever change his mind, there was a home for him at the mill. Jackman was partly relieved, but sorry too. He knew how Laura worried about her old mentor and his safety, out there on the edge of a bird reserve.
"Sir?" Kevin tapped on Jackman's half-open door. "Can I come in?"
"Sure, Kevin. What's the problem?"
"No problem, sir. The Sarge asked me to find out the make of Henry Arnott's car. It's a Kia Sportage SUV, sir. A 2018 model in what Kia describes as mineral silver, grey, to you and me."
He handed him a memo with the registration number written on it.
"The tyres are Hankook, in case we need to compare the tracks."
"Nice one, Kevin, thank you."
Jackman looked up at the new member of the team.
"Sit for a moment." Kevin sat, looking a trifle nervous. He was smartly dressed, wearing what was obviously a brand new suit. Jackman was pleased. It showed he took pride in his work.
"I'm sorry you've been dumped in at the deep end, Kevin. It was my intention to take the time to show you the ropes, but that's the nature of detective work. You can't always do what you like. You will get more attention, I promise, but you can see how difficult it is at the moment."
"I'm very aware of the circumstances, sir. Please don't give it another thought. I'm happy to help in any way I can."
"And how are you getting on, Kevin? Has the transition from uniform been a shock to the system?"
What Jackman really wanted to ask was whether Kevin had recovered from the horrors of the Alastair Ashcroft case, but that wasn't possible. Kevin Stoner was lucky to be with them still, and to have retained his sanity after some of the things he had witnessed.
"As you say, sir, takes a bit of getting used to. I knew my old job backwards, but there's a lot I have to learn here."
He hesitated, suddenly anxious.
"I just hope I can make the grade."
Jackman smiled at him.
"Don't worry, Kevin. It's early days. You'll settle in no time at all. You're a good copper, and I'm glad you've joined us."
"I appreciate that, D.I. Jackman. I won't let you down."
"I know you won't."
Now, what are you working on at present? Jackman asked.
I'm waiting for the Sarge to come in and find me something to do, sir.
Right, well, unless she's got something special for you, perhaps you would find out which abandoned properties were checked and cleared last night in the hunt for Keith Hazel. I need to know which ones we can cross off our list and which have still to be visited. Liaise with uniform. That young man can't have been taken far.
Kevin stood up.
Straight away, boss.
Jackman watched him go. He seemed to be holding up really well. But only a few months ago, the lad had been in a terrible state. He had to have been damaged by Ashcroft. At least Kevin hadn't been present at the finding of the three hanged bodies in the church tower. That might well have pushed him over the edge. The forensic photos, up on the whiteboard, were like the news on the TV. They couldn't convey the horror of witnessing sights firsthand. And what of Keith Hazel? Was he already hanging somewhere, suspended by one ankle? And if he was, how long did he have to live? He wondered if it was too early for Rory to be in. He picked up the phone. Rory answered almost immediately.
Oh, may, before breakfast, too. Thank you, dear Inspector, and a very good morning to you as well.
He paused, listening to Jackman's question, then asked,
Is he young?
Early 20s, Rory.
Overweight?
Far from it. Wiry and quite skinny. Probably one of the reasons he was carried off so quickly.
Well, that goes in his favour. The younger you are, the more likely you are to survive.
But for how long, Rory? How long do we have before?
Rory sighed.
I can't tell you, Jackman. Our bodies aren't designed to hang head down. The lungs can't take in enough oxygen. If they are being crushed by the heavier liver and intestines, blood can pool in the brain and cause ruptured vessels or even a brain hemorrhage. The heart struggles. It slows down because it's receiving more blood than it can cope with, and it can't maintain blood pressure. And all that is without simple dehydration, the pressure building in your eyes, and finally, asphyxiation.
Please, Prof, just a ballpark guesstimate.
I read about a man who lasted 28 hours once, after a rappelling accident. He too was suspended by one foot, but he died because they couldn't free him from the crevice he'd fallen into.
Rory took a breath.
I'm assuming your killer will use the same method as before, so, at a wild guess, I'd say somewhere around 12 hours from the time he was suspended, and that is assuming he is fit and healthy with no underlying medical conditions.
Jackman groaned. It wasn't long enough. It was already almost 8 in the morning, and Keith could have been hung up at any time during the previous evening.
Listen, don't hold me to that, Jackman. It's very much an unknown area, and there are so many variables. He could last much longer if he finds some way to reach the rope and get his head up again. Don't give up on him. He's young. He could surprise you.
If I can find him.
Well, I'm in so early because I want to try and find some forensic evidence to help you identify your killer, and I've dragged poor Spike and Cardiff from their respective beds to help me. So, nil desperandum, as they say.
Jackman thanked Rory and hung up. He looked up to see Marie standing in the doorway, balancing two cups of coffee and a brown bag on top of a pile of reports. She was smiling broadly.
You look ridiculously bright.
Did the postcode lottery knock on your door this morning?
Last night Marie had looked anxious and tired. Now she positively glowed.
She laughed.
Amazing what a good night's sleep can do. By the way, I have a favour to ask.
He stared at the brown bag.
Is this a bribe?
Consider it more of a goodwill gesture.
He opened it. Inside was a filled breakfast croissant, the local coffee shop's ham and cheese speciality. It was still warm.
Okay, ask away.
I want to go out to Randleby Airfield. It was the last place Aaron Smith was seen alive, and I want a forensic sweep done. She stared at him hopefully. I know Fenchester is insisting he ran away because he was frightened and that it's not a crime scene at all, but I think differently.
Jackman thought about this. The fact of the other young men, all dead, seemed to point to Marie being right, and Fenchester wrong. But he wondered if there was any point. Would anything show up there, when the other two scenes had thrown up zilch?
He said as much to Marie, adding, The budget is pretty strung out already, Marie, and didn't you say your mole inside Fenchester Nick had been warned off rather conclusively? Most importantly, we have that missing kid, Keith Hazel, to find, and time is running out for him.
She nodded. I know that, sir.
But what exactly can the two of us do? Uniform are searching every available abandoned building in the area, and Max, Robbie and Gary, Kevin too, are tracing any and every lead we have. From this morning, we also have Orak on the case, which is massive. So couldn't you spare me for a few hours, so I can take a couple of uniforms and a socko out there? Just to do an official walkthrough in daylight and see if there's anything that doesn't look right? Marie wouldn't have asked, if this wasn't important to her. She didn't often beg him for favours.
Okay, he sighed. Let's say I agree, but we need permission to carry out a search if we don't have a warrant.
Not if we hear cries for help or distress, said Marie angelically, or are there to sort out a reported disturbance of some kind.
Or, he said soberly, we could obtain a warrant, Marie, because we believe there is material on the premises which is likely to be of substantial value to our investigation. It would cover our backs.
And take precious time, boss. I don't want to be away from here for any longer than necessary.
She sounded so reasonable. Finally, he said, be back here by 11 at the latest, and if you see anything worth flagging up, ring me. But don't, I repeat, don't bring the wrath of Ruth Crook down on us by stepping out of line. We both know there is something odd about that place, and I can't afford to let anything at all interfere with the search for that missing explorer.
Marie stood up. I'll try and arrange for a crew to accompany me and get a socko to meet us there. I promise I'll be back in under 3 hours. She stopped at the door. Thank you, Jackman.
Bugger off, Marie, and hurry back.
Even Marie wouldn't go this far to rescue a motorbike, so he hadn't mentioned it, but it did cross his mind that she would use the opportunity to check that the old Norton was still under that bench. And she was right. The place was probably the scene of an abduction that had led to a death, so it should be checked as thoroughly as the other crime scenes. It was just that he had very bad vibes about Randleby Airfield. Now that her computers were all up and running, Orak began to feel a little more human again, and the others all seemed happy to see her back at her workstation. Philip brought her some information she had asked for. She noticed he was wearing a new silk tie, sunshine yellow and covered in bright green Irish four-leaf clovers. This made even Orak smile. Grinning broadly, Philip told her it was a present from Marie Evans. She stared at the thick file Marie had brought down for her. She was now ready to tackle it. Prior to her trip to Ireland, she would have gone straight into work mode and put everything else aside. Now, she found that she had lost that single-minded capacity to concentrate. Pictures of her beautiful grandmother kept floating into her head, distracting her. She carried the photo in her bag. Deep within, the dark-haired, beautiful young woman, so grown up now, so self-assured, a child lived on. The child she remembered, her dear baby sister. She took a few deep breaths. Concentrate, Orak. In some ways, she wished she'd never made that trip to Ireland. It had done little but leave her more disturbed than before. Yes, she now knew that her sister had survived and even prospered, and that was of incalculable value. But now she had new dilemmas to untangle, and some very difficult decisions to make. She stood up and went through to the locker room. Maybe a few words with Dara would settle her racing mind. He answered at once. My Kiera, are you all right? I'm fine, she lied. Just a little wobbly after everything Ireland decided to throw at me. I hope I didn't cause you more trouble. Of course not, Dara. You gave me back my sister. How could that be trouble to me?
It's still an almighty shock, so just relax for a day or so. Take some time off to assimilate everything.
His calm voice was so reassuring. So, where are you now, my friend?
Still in Dublin, just about to pay a visit to Trinity College. I've been promising myself a look at the Book of Kells since I don't know when. I'm looking forward to soaking up a little of our heritage. And then it's back home, he sighed.
I wish you'd stayed here. We could have continued your search for your sister together. I know you had to do the first part alone, but as soon as you knew she was alive, I could have gone with you, supported you.
Like in the old days.
I almost did, I was so close. But then I realized I was too close. I needed to think, and I couldn't do it there, she said.
Well, as long as you believe you did the right thing.
Oh, I almost forgot. I think I've solved the mystery of the amateur sleuth who was stalking you, and I'm afraid I'm inadvertently to blame. She frowned. How so?
I confess to being afraid for his safety, Kira. I persuaded a very capable friend of mine to track you down and then keep a watchful eye on you. He couldn't find you at first. Another laugh. You obviously still have your old skills. But anyway, when he finally located you, he was taken ill and finished up in hospital, and I thought that was that. What I didn't know was that, not wanting to let me down, he asked his brother to watch over you. Evidently, he wasn't very good at surveillance. I'm so sorry. He must have frightened you. That wasn't how it was meant to be at all. I only found this out last night. It was Aurak's turn to laugh. I wasn't exactly frightened. His ineptitude just puzzled me. But at least that answers one question that was bothering me. Good. Now, when I get back, shall we have a meal together? It's been far too long since we met. I'd like that. Ring me when you're home. Of course. 2 days and my business will all be finished. Remember, take some time for yourself. It will do you the world of good. See you soon.
Aurak returned to her computers feeling much less anxious. Marie had been right all along. Dara had been worried about her. Nevertheless, she would ignore his advice. What she needed right now was work. She flexed her fingers and began her research.
Chapter 30 Robbie entered Jackman's office. This case, his baby, had rapidly turned into a nightmare. If he was in for a dressing down, well, he deserved it. Surely, by now he should have found something that tied the victims together, but he'd found nothing. Jackman pointed to a chair, and Robbie sat, feeling like a rabbit caught in the headlights.
Any progress, Robbie? Anything at all that might tell us where this killer could have taken young Keith Hazel?
Robbie shook his head.
Kevin Steiner has brought back the list of abandoned buildings that were searched, and we've been trying to put the remaining ones into some sort of order. Every available Fenland copper is out there searching, but it's like looking for a needle in a haystack, sir. I've even got Will Sheringham and Stella checking my selection since they know most of these old places better than us.
Good idea.
Jackman nibbled absent-mindedly on his thumbnail.
And of course, the magician could have squirreled Keith away anywhere. We're only guessing that he wants to do a repeat performance of his weird hanging routine.
I think that's as objective though, boss, don't you?
Robbie relaxed. Now he knew he was not in for a talking to.
I can't help looking at that tarot card of the hanged man.
Indeed, said Jackman. But on a different subject, were the press outside when you arrived, Robbie?
Were they? A whole bunch of reporters and cameras gathered all around the entrance. The duty sergeant said the super will be making another announcement this morning.
Then I'd better go and speak to her. Oh, and if my desk phone rings, could you get it for me? Marie's out at Randleby, and I don't want to miss her call if she rings on the landline and not my mobile.
Sure, boss. I'll listen out.
Robbie was concerned for her. Everything they'd heard about that place screamed trouble, and he didn't want Marie getting into hot water over it. He would have gone too, or at least sent Gary to accompany her, but she had insisted they were needed on the hunt for Keith Hazel, and he could hardly argue with her. He had been horrified to discover just how many buildings in the area were empty, abandoned, or deserted. It was a mammoth task. Back at his desk, his own phone rang. It was Stella.
I'm not sure if this is relevant, but our emergency website, UESOS, has coughed up the name of a local lad who says he's afraid that he might be next in line for an abduction. He's well frightened, Robbie. I think he's worth a visit.
Robbie grabbed a pen and scribbled down the name. Alfie Brown.
Address?
Anvil Cottage, Rustings Lane, Cartoft Village.
She gave him Alfie's mobile number.
Could be useful. I'll check him out straight away.
Stella, did he say why he felt threatened? There was a short silence. Then she said,
Because he's the first person we've found that has been out exploring with all four of the killer's victims.
Thank you, Stella. This could be the break we need.
Robbie immediately rang the number that Stella had given him.
I'm at work, officer, but I have a break in 3/4 of an hour. I'm a porter at Salton Hospital. If you could come here?
Robbie said he would, and hung up. Even in that short conversation, Alfie Brown had managed to sound strung out. The hospital was only a 5-minute drive from the station. He went over to where Max was furiously typing something into his computer.
Max, I've got a UE to see. He reckons he could be next in line for one of the magician's disappearing acts.
Max looked up.
How come?
Robbie explained.
Wow, if he's right, he could be the missing link, couldn't he?
Max opened his eyes wide.
He might know something or somewhere that connects them all.
I'm going to meet him at his workplace. But if he really is a possible link, I'll bring him back to the station and let Jackman talk to him.
He frowned at Max.
And he might need protection. If the magician realizes Alfie knows he's after him, he could just snatch him off the streets.
Well, if I were you, I wouldn't wait. I'd get my ass round there right now. Our killer could have his eye on him already.
So far, all the urbexes that the magician had taken had gone out despite the danger. But if someone on his list, Alfie Brown, for instance, decided against exploring for a while, then he would have no alternative but to abduct him either from his home, the streets, or from where he worked.
You're right. Tell the boss what I'm doing, would you? And Max, can you field any calls to Jackman's office? Maureen might ring, and he doesn't want to miss our call.
You got it, Rob. I'm all ears.
As Robbie hurried across to one of the CID cars, he saw a squad car pull in. Two uniformed officers and Marie got out. He went over to her. She looked like thunder. Warrant or bugger off? At least that was the gist of it. And how on earth did they know we were going there in the first place? We arrived to find a couple of vans and a 4x4 there. Then some bloke said they were surveying the ground in preparation for work being carried out and he couldn't let us in without the owner's permission.
So, who is the owner? Robbie asked.
He couldn't or wouldn't say. Just said to come back with a warrant and he'd make sure the owner was present. She kicked at some loose gravel. Frankly, I didn't dare take it further, and I couldn't afford to waste time out there. Jackman's right. We have more serious things on our hands right now. She shrugged.
It's just galling.
And where are you off to?
Actually, I need to rush.
He explained quickly and made to hurry away.
Take care,
called out Marie. One hint of concern for him, you bring him straight back here, okay?
Wilco,
he called back and ran. When Marie entered the CID room, Jackman was just coming out of his office. His look of relief at seeing her was almost comic.
You were right, boss. I got sent packing and told to get a warrant, which I'd never gone. She pulled a face. But it's bugging me even more now. Clearly something's going on out there. We didn't tell a soul where we were going.
You're right, Marie. It is odd. But I'm afraid it will have to go on the back burner for a while, and to be honest, I don't think we'd find anything by way of interesting forensic evidence there. After all, none of the other abduction sites did.
He looked distracted. Has something happened?
She asked. Laura's just called. She phoned Callie Prothero to check her appointment time, and Henry Arnott told her that Callie was sleeping. He said she'd had a bad night, and he was loath to disturb her. Jackman gave an annoyed grunt.
It may be absolutely genuine, but I don't know. Am I being paranoid?
No, sir.
No way. But it's a tough call. Going back again could be construed.